It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the cinemas and on DVD. Get ready for...
Wait for it!
Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Sozi!
No, that's Matthew Sozi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever. Yeah.
Let's find out how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sozi.
There are rich teams and there are poor teams. Then there's 50 feet of crap. And then there's us.
Hello there, film lovers. And welcome to Film Sociology, the Oakland A's of film shows, apparently, here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, like why, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. Also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sozi. The show is available as a podcast. It's also available on iTunes. And we have a blog, which you can check out at filmsociology.tumblr.com. Why am I saying that information? Because the normal person sitting in this chair, Kobe Slagle, well, he's out camping. I can say that. He is out camping with his Immortal Beloved and other Gary Oldman films. And, of course, Kobe is getting married in a couple of weeks. So Chris Lloyd from the Film Me App and Indie Style debut this morning.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming in.
I'm officially a multimedia kind of guy.
You are, yes. And so, or is your 4 minutes on Indie Style, as I like to call it, your film sociology warm-up? 4 minutes of TV's got nothing on 59 of intense HD2 action.
Yeah, although it is too bad not having Kobe here. Although, for those who don't know Kobe, saying, like, Kobe is going camping, you know, doesn't really just roll off the tongues. It's sort of like saying, you know, Adolf Hitler, oh, he's at a bat mitzvah. You know, just not something normally associated with that person.
Kobe is like, now I think we talked, you are like this as well. My version of roughing it is basic cable. Basic cable, or instead of a hotel, a motor lodge, which means the door is outside.
Well, this time of year, I don't care where I am as long as I'm sitting inside directly under an air conditioning vent.
Here, here. So have fun, Kobe. Have one for us. All right. So you made your debut, and we'll talk a little bit about it. We are having dead people we like. There's a lot of dead people we like this past week.
Just because we're indiscriminate in our liking of dead people.
That's right. So that's our way of saying movie obits, relax people.
We're not cinematic necrophiliacs around here.
No, but we think respect must be paid, and it might be a reminder, because I kind of do this music-wise on the Blue Show, is you might want to check out some of the works by some of these people that are that have recently left us. It might be a little reminder that, hey, you should check out so-and-so's work.
Yeah, East of Eden, not to jump the head, but right. Literally been in my Netflix queue for I don't know how many months, so hopefully I will get to it soon.
It's strange what happens. Yes, we have, it is true, we have stacks of movies in our houses, our own separate houses, and sometimes some get to the top a lot quicker than others, and news and ideas just come screaming at times.
Yeah, if I was to count up like all the movies currently waiting on my DVR, plus all the movies in my Netflix DVD queue, plus all the in my streaming Netflix queue, that would be a big number.
Yeah, so there are days we wish you don't get a serious injury like pneumonia or a broken leg, but it would help you get through some of those. Me too. So, all right. Opening in theaters this week, we will start with the stuff we didn't see. Close Circuit, which is the English espionage thriller with Eric Bana, Rebecca Hall, Jim Broadbent, Kieran Hines, one of my favorite that guys. And it's one of these, I think, you did a summation of the plot on Indie Style. Go ahead.
Yeah, now I believe it's from the same people that made Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy.
I love that they push from the producers of them. Ooh, the people who got the money to get them. It's one thing if it's a director or a writer or a star, but I'm like, ooh, the people who got the money to make this espionage thriller. Ooh, okay.
Yes, exactly. but it is kind of along that same vine. It's very much that, you know, in the world of terrorism, espionage, black ops, you know,
right,
where the government is doing things we don't necessarily know about. And so it's about a big terrorism attack has occurred in Great Britain, and Eric Bana, I believe, and Rebecca Hall play defense lawyers or barristers, as they call them across the pond.
The ones with the wigs.
Yes. They literally wear wigs in this.
They do. They still do. That was not a punchline in A Fish Called Wanda. Still do that.
And not Merkins, real wigs.
Very good.
But that might be a more interesting film. But so they actually get assigned to be the defenders of the accused terrorist. And, of course, you know,
You've already just shut off like 75% of the country on that
Yeah.
What do you mean they get a defense?
Well, I think they're like the equivalent of public defenders over here, and somebody has to be their lawyer, so it's them.
So would these people defend Matt Damon in Elysium?
That would be them.
We already joked about Elysium and how it's not the north side of a certain city. No, anyway.
Yes. for those, most people might be aware London is like one of the most surveyed cities in the world. So like 500,000 cameras on the streets.
I think they use that in the trailer to let you know that Big Brother is really watching out for your benefit.
So there's a lot of like cross-cutting and editing and, you know, seeing like all these different monitors with things going on. So it looks interesting. It actually opened here on Wednesday. Without much fanfare, certainly not without a screening. It looks interesting to me. I don't know why we didn't hear more about it.
I would love to have seen this. Now, there's a little, we were talking off air about little things that we have as things to make our lives as critics a little easier, especially as critics who are also parents. But I know sometimes you get a film like Closed Circuit or even the films that open on Thursday, and sometimes they will do one, maybe two screenings the night before it officially opens, which, by the way, folks, really, really smart move.
Yeah.
Because sometimes life gets in the way of being a rip-roaring film critic and, you know, you either see it late Thursday night or first thing Friday morning, and then you can still talk about it here Fridays at 5 in Film Sociology. But where I live, I was really hoping they would show Closed Circuit on Wednesday. This didn't even come to town on Wednesday. This really kind of bummed me out. The film that did have one screening in advance on a Thursday night in my beloved town, which I won't tell you about, it's not that big a secret, but it is the concert documentary film One Direction, This Is Us, directed by Morgan Spurlock, who we'll get to in a little bit, but I have, straight from the Filmy app, with his permission, we have a review of One Direction. She is not taking over the kids film correspondent job that's recently held by my lovely daughter. But anyway, here is a direction of One Direction by an actual target member of the audience.
This is Jenna Shear with the Filmy app, and I am going to be reviewing One Direction, This Is Us. This was a very good movie about the band One Direction. But you see them when they're playing songs and when they're not playing songs and when they're fooling around. And my favorite part was when Liam pulled down Harry's pants. When they were on stage singing, Liam snuck up behind Harry and he pulled down Harry's pants. And we saw his underwear and... very funny, and I would give One Direction, This Is Us, 5 yaps.
Well, I guess the suburban moms that like Taylor Lautner, they want to go see this now that some kid's pants are pulled down.
Yes, exactly. Keep in mind, this young and beautiful lass we're talking about is only, I think, 6 or 7 years old. So
yeah,
to her, underwear is just funny
it
and
is
not
just
Miley
funny.
Cyrus connotations.
No, it's bad timing on that. And if you see the clip on the film, that was great because she's kind of looking off to the side, I'm assuming at Joe, to make sure she's not in trouble for saying underwear on the internet. You're okay, honey.
Yeah.
It's okay.
So go to the film app to catch that whole video. And also, Joe also has a full grown-up review on there of what he thought about it.
Oh, he did? Okay.
Which is, he basically says, it's just okay. It's kind of a standard concert flick for a young bebop, you know, boys band that's going to be gone in 5 years.
If you're into that, sorry. So did he tell her that?
He didn't tell her that.
I would.
He really still be gone in 5 years.
I remember taking Emma to see the last song, speaking of Miley Cyrus, and I'm like,
she's doing something.
Boy, she's doing something. Being basically made her work in the last song seem like Julie Harris.
Yeah. So what's Morgan Spurlock doing? I mean, is this just the most, I don't want to be too cynical, but is this just the most blatant cashing a paycheck move
I'm guessing this gets him a little more notoriety. I'm sure he was paid well to run around with One Direction. Don't think he told the boys to pull his pants down. see the movie. You'll understand what we're talking
about. Did he make them all eat quarter pounders the whole time?
Every day. You know, but you know what? Those kids, those darn kids, they probably got great metabolism, so it wouldn't do anything.
Yep.
No, this is not the first time that we've had a named director, do a concert documentary. We'll get into that. And by the way, I love, she is dead on. In a concert documentary, you see the film where they're singing, and then when they're not singing. That's
exactly. The definition of a concert film.
That's right up there with plot things happen.
Does it say anything about me and how old and uncool I am that until this movie was coming out, I first heard about it a month ago, I had never heard of One Direction?
I had to go to Emma and say, do you know these people? And I got the eye rolling, yes. Okay, that's all I need to know. That's fine. No posters of these guys on my daughter's wall. So I'm guessing it's really, can you think of the last Morgan Spurlock film you saw after Super Size Me? I saw Where in the World is Osama Bin Laden.
He was doing some TV stuff.
He was
most
doing
recently.
Some TV stuff, and I know he had done a couple of. I think there was a film about, metrosexuals. I think he did one on that a couple of years back that I remember The Onion gave a very trashing review of. But I'm guessing this gets his name out there, and this might lead to a little more wider release of his future projects, whatever that will be.
Well, I mean, trying to make it as a documentarian is not exactly a great going concern. So.
No, it's not.
So, yeah, I mean, it's like what we said about Super Size Me from a few years ago. I remember I reviewed it. It says, this is totally a gimmick movie, but it's a really good gimmick. So.
Yeah, and in fact, I'm Emma is intrigued. So I'm going to – if I can get – not in the same night, Super Size Me and Food, Inc., that might be ones that to try to revisit.
Yeah, I don't feel too great about Food, Inc. or Super Size Me because, you know, at the end phase where he's now, like, you know, in his fat Elvis phase there at the end, then he looks just about like me, you know. And then I'm the after of the Super Size Me experiment.
Try looking like Jim Morrison in Paris. So that leads us to In the Onion. And don't worry, we'll get to the other movies this week. I assure you, we have an hour. Actually, we have 47 minutes. The Onion, great AV club, of course. They're fine. One of my number one sources here at Film Sociology. But they do an inventory on Mondays of pop culture inventory. And I think because of One Direction, Morgan Spurlock, they did 16 concert films and one concert series by famous directors. And so some of these, believe it or not, there's a few of these I've not heard. There's a couple of these I don't even own. And these are not in any particular order, but the first thing they do, and it comes with the picture, Jonathan Demme directing Stop Making Sense,
mm-hmm.
which if I remember this, and this was 6 years after The Last Waltz. So, I mean, concert documentaries came every couple of years. It was kind of different. And I think at that time I was 14. It was, are you into this band or not? And I was not really into the Talking Heads at that time. But anyway, that's of course a memorable one. Now, also on the list, 1970s Gimme Shelter with Albert and David Mazes, and of course about the Rolling Stones concert and the terrible things that happened at the Altamont Speedway. Number three, The Last Waltz, Martin Scorsese. I loved it. I know a lot of people in the band who are fans of the band and don't like Robbie Robertson are not thrilled with the film. But I think it's a fantastic concert. And
one of the most pure concert movies is that I'm trying to remember. I mean, it's pretty much really about the concert,
well,
not too much off-screen.
There is actually some off-screen stuff. But
the ratio is...
Yeah, but the majority of the interviews usually evolve around Robbie Robertson because, well, he and Scorsese at that time were kind of arm in arm. And I think they were living together for a while in their debauchery times. Number four, Dave Chappelle's Block Party, directed by Michel Gondry. Fans of Eternal Sunshine and those on that. Jonathan Demme, who did, I've seen two of these three films, loved one, liked the other, and I'm intrigued. But Neil Young's Heart of Gold, Neil Young Trunk Show, and Neil Young Journeys. Now, Neil Young Heart of Gold, I remember that made my top 10 in 2006. And it was just him. No audience cutbacks, you know, no shots of the crowd, no shots of him walking around Nashville. Because it was at the Ryman Center. It was just him on stage, an acoustic performance. Really, really enjoyed it. Number six, Buena Vista Social Club, directed by Wim Wenders. And actually, I think one of the members of the Social Club is coming to Clues next month. So be on the lookout for that. Shine a Light, directed by Martin Scorsese. And it's fun because the prep the work for this. It was Scorsese is trying to prepare it ahead of time, and Mick Jagger is being Mick Jagger. Basically, he's not ready to give him the set list. He's not sure where he's going to wind up on stage. He's constantly moving, even though he's 140 years old and skinnier than this microphone. That's fun. Year of the Horse by Jim Jarmusch, about Neil Young and Crazy Horse. Taylor Hackford directing Chuck Berry, Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll. Famous for anything else, Chuck Berry chewing out Keith Richards, and Richards didn't object. Like that. This is one I don't have and I have not seen. Andy Warhol and Paul Morrissey directing The Velvet Underground and Nico, A Symphony of Sound, from 1966. Let's Spend the Night Together, directed by Hal Ashby, about the 1981 North American tour of the Rolling Stones. Jonathan Demme with Storefront Hitchcock, which is basically Robin Hitchcock performing solo in a storefront. There's that. Todd Phillips, Bittersweet Motel. Yes, 9012 Live from 1985, directed by Steven Soderbergh.
Wow.
This was his big deal before Sex, Lies, and Videotape. David Fincher, The Beat of the Live Drum. And then finally, American Express, the Upstage series from 2010. And apparently you had a series of directors doing different bands. David Lynch filming Duran Duran. Todd Haynes directing My Morning Jacket. Coldplay and Anton Corbijn working together. Kenny Chesney directed by Jonathan Demme. And Werner Herzog directing a documentary about the Killers. Now I want Werner Herzog to direct One Direction. I would like that. So anyway, those are some concert films by other named directors. Now, we will get to a film that that Chris talked about on Indie Style, and I got to see. And of course, when I first saw the title, I was dreading it was going to be another remake of the Sam Peckinpah film.
Yeah.
It is not. Not since Killer Elite, the Jason Statham, Clive Owen, Robert De Niro film. And I thought, oh, they're going to remake The Killer Elite. No, it's a different title. This is Getaway, and this is Ethan Hawke, Selena Gomez, and the voice of John Voight.
Where are you taking me?
Leanne? Leanne, can you hear me?
Brent, what's going on?
Are you okay? Have they hurt you? Put my wife back on!
Is she alive?
For now. She will remain that way as long as you follow my instructions. Drive. I know who you are. You have a beautiful wife. And an ability few others have. Now, I have you. I'm watching you. Always. You will await further instructions.
Get out.
You got the wrong car.
Get out of the car!
Drive away now.
I can't!
Drive away. Take her with you.
What do you want me to do with her?
Kill her.
I'm not a killer.
Good. You will need her help if you want your wife back.
I'm going to make you an offer.
What is he after?
I don't know. Do exactly as I say, and your wife lives.
She's beautiful.
Refuse or get caught, the game's over. She dies. The clock is ticking.
What happens when this is done? Why would he even give her back to you?
It seems like an obvious choice to me.
Hold on!
But I give you a moment to think about it.
I'm not dying for you.
5, 4, 3.
I need to be told that she is all right.
2.
And when this is going to be over.
1. Your answer, Mr. Magna.
I want my wife back.
All right. Let me tell you about this film before going to see this film. Believe it or not, ladies and gentlemen, film critics are human beings. I know.
A lower form of them, but.
I know. And we've been told that. Yeah, we're heartless and we hate things and we're old and crotchety and we hate everything. We don't like stuff and we just, you know, nitpick. That's all we do. Now, sometimes we go and we do our best to, when we get into a theater, try to, shut off the outside world, focus on the film itself and a little camaraderie, a little chat banter with our fellow critics before and after, not during. But sometimes life gets in the way and sometimes it helps and sometimes it hinders a viewing experience. Case in point, next week on DVD and Blu-ray is the magical heist film Now You See Me. And I remember I was in a lousy, lousy mood walking into the theater. And I think it had something to do with my review of the film. So I'm going to give it another shot, especially when everybody else around me really liked it and I thought it was just okay. So we'll see what happens. Going into Getaway, you had summed it up on Indie Style. If you just flip your brain off and just let it wash over you. Yeah, exactly. Just don't even think about it. And there are some films that you can nitpick at them, and if I start asking questions like that, it tends to get in the way. And sometimes, and there are also times that if I'm asking those questions, and then somewhere the other half of my brain just says, who cares? And I think Getaway benefits from the who cares factor.
Yeah.
By the way, so the old people sitting behind us, you suck. Shut up. Go away. And there was something, and it was really, even my daughter, even said, are these people at the movies all the time? Yes, they are. There's a certain number of people that get free screeners in the mail. They're grandfathered in, so to speak, forever, and they keep coming. Well, some of them need to shut up. And if you know these people, tell them to shut up. And if you don't, and you know people who talk in the movies, tell them to shut up. So, because unfortunately, I don't want to be the one that sends my daughter out to get the manager to tell them to be quiet because I don't want to miss the movie. Now, that being said, there's a lot of, I think you, what was it? You called it, because there were elements we talked about. There's Taken, there's Saw, there's 12 Rounds. Joe Scheer, you're a fan of the John Cena action film.
Yeah. Mostly it's speed.
Speed, yeah.
The whole thing is like people are trapped on a vehicle, or, you know, not literally trapped, but, you know, like being watched while they're in the vehicle and having to be, you know, ordered around to do stuff.
By John Voight, basically.
By John Voight.
And this one, and of course, the only thing that the old people brought up was, you know, when does he put gas in the car? You know what? You also break down what Jack Bauer does in 24, okay?
But I will admit I had that same thought because he does a lot of driving.
He does a lot of driving. So, yeah, go ahead and tell folks a little bit more about the break it down a little bit.
So it's pretty much, it's one of those movies, it starts right in the middle of things. Guy comes back to his apartment in Sofia, Bulgaria.
Interesting choice. And also interior shot in Atlanta.
Yeah, interiors are shot in Atlanta. But they did shoot a lot of the action scenes outside to get the nice old architecture.
And I think also to bring in the Euro bucks.
And he comes back to his apartment and his wife is abducted. And he gets a call, like, you know, one of those things, you must be at some place at some certain time. And he goes there and he's like, there's a car. Steal it. He gets in this car.
And, by the way, you're the gearhead here at Film Sociology. What kind of car is it?
That's a real car. That is a Ford Shelby Mustang GT500 Super Snake. Very limited. I mean, this is not something that Ford actually makes. This is just a thing where Ford has partnerships with several other things where they buy basically a shell of a Mustang, put their own engine in it, soup the thing up to all get out.
It's a Lance Armstrong A-Rod car.
It's probably like a $75,000 car, and wow. It is. You're talking like 600 horsepower, serious badassery.
And by the way, and if, I would be interested when it comes out on DVD how many of these they went through, because you were told early on it's steel-plated.
Well, they said it's armored.
armor-plated. So.
Yeah, and so you know, he's driving around in this thing, and the guy, there's cameras mounted outside and inside the car, and the guy's talking to him, saying, you go here, turn left here, drive through that park full of people, mow down all the Christmas decorations.
But don't actually kill anybody.
Yeah.
Nobody is killed. That's good. You know what? It's the driving school of the bad guys from the A-Team.
Yeah, and eventually, you know, of course, then he picks up this really smart girl who knows computers and hacking, played by Selena Gomez, and she has a personal interest in this particular vehicle that he's in that I won't reveal.
Right.
And so then, you know, it devolves to it, basically anytime things slow down and they stop the car or they're just driving along at a normal speed and they're talking and things slow down, it just boom, you know, out of the side street wherever they're at, either a police, you know, bunch of police cars or a bunch of bad guys, you know, in black sedans or motorcycles come out with machine guns and the race is on again and we do 10 more minutes of stunts. This is a B movie. It's definitely yes. a B movie, but the car stunts, the car crashes are A-list. It's really good stunt work.
And there is a mixture of, and I would say this is not a perfect film.
Oh God, no.
No. Yeah, when as you mentioned, when they're not chased and it's the two of them talking, that gets really old really fast.
Yeah.
Now, don't worry, they're not going to hook up his lovers because Ethan Hawke must have his woman, even though he dumped Uma Thurman. But you know, they're working together as a team.
And eventually, we'll, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, of course, they don't like each other at the beginning because you need conflict, even if you're trapped inside a car.
It's a dumb, fun movie.
Big time dumb.
Big time dumb. It's one of those things where you just, like, you know, literally, I mean, if you start thinking about it for even, you know, more than 5 seconds, it pretty much falls apart. But it's a fun movie. You know, I mean, things like, you know, they're shot at 8 million times in this thing, and, you know, God knows how many police roadblocks they run up against. At no point does anyone shoot at the tires or...
Oh, those are also armor-plated.
Or put down nails or something on the roads to, you know...
They don't have those in Bulgaria yet. They don't have the big strand of wire to blow out the tires.
It's dumb.
Exactly. But, you know, if you don't look at those terms, and you know, just look at the car crashes and sort of the adrenaline ride, and you mentioned a very specific car stunt in this that you really like.
Yeah, I'm going to say, that was what I was saying earlier, the level of stunt work, and the car stunts in this film, they're pretty impressive. I'm always intrigued to see how much of it is actual car driving, how much of it is CG. Now, I mean, you can place cars passing through so nobody gets seriously hurt, things like that.
I think it's probably like 97% real. They might have like enhanced some of the explosions with CG.
Right, because yeah, you know what? But but when I say it, there's various levels of where it really works. Sometimes it is a little, you know, AD&D, and there's a lot of mass cutting, and of course I'm gonna. Let me get on the front stoop here. If I'm going to see cars crash into each other, just like if I'm going to see two robots or a giant robot fighting in the Pacific Rim, I want to see it. I want to see. Even if it's – call me old-fashioned. I'm old-fashioned. But I want to see that. And you do get some of it, but there is one shot in particular I was kind of impressed with, and it's basically a camera mounted on front of the car, and it goes – a single take for about, I don't know, a minute, 2 minutes maybe. And this is where I wouldn't be disappointed if, you know, there's cars passing via the intersection and they just almost get hit, but they don't. And I wouldn't be surprised if those were CG. That's fine. But the fact that they took some time out to have a shot of a car chasing another car from the front of the car's point of view.
Yeah.
I like that. If there was more of that, I probably would like more. Then people probably would have thought it would be Death Proof.
I like the car. I like how the car becomes a character in the movie, like other.
But it's not voiced by William Daniels.
No, but you know, like a lot of, you know, cinematic Mustangs of yore, you know, Bullet, Gone in 60 Seconds. And I'm not sure if this, the Mustang in this
the
movie.
The original, are you talking the original Gone in 60 Seconds?
Both of them. I like the Mustang in both of them.
Okay.
But, it really, and the thing is, you know, even though it's armored and it's super tough, the car does, you know, over time get more and more progressively chewed up. And it sort of ends up being like the cop car that the boys drive in Blues Brothers, where, you know, where by the
it just falls apart.
Like, yeah, you know, where it eventually has its ultimate demise, and you just feel bad about that for a minute because, you know, it was such a great performer in the movie, so to speak.
Yeah. So, and I will say, you mentioned earlier, this did lead to showing my daughter the chase scene in Bullet and the chase scene in The French Connection and Death Proof. Not all of it, but some of it.
Bullet, that was, they got a brand new 1968 Ford Mustang, before they got it with, but the 428, engine before they were available to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And my memory of that is that they actually used one car for that whole, to do that whole thing. And by the end, Steve McQueen did a lot of the wheel work himself.
Oh yeah, because you had to pry him away from a vehicle for him to not do stunt work.
And so, you know, whatever it was, a week, 2 weeks, whatever they spent shooting that very extended scene. That by the end, I think they went through several rounds of tires on the car.
I would be surprised.
But the engine, so they went from a brand spanking new factory engine to the engine was completely worn out by the end of them shooting that sequence.
And that film won an Academy Award for Best Editing. And well deserved. So, and now, yeah, I think I need to show Emma the Blues Brothers, not just because of the car stuff, but because of the music. So,
one of my all-time favorite comedies.
Absolutely.
One of the funniest movies ever made, as far as I'm concerned, right up there with Some Like It Hot or whatever you want to say.
And a fine, fine film shot in the city of Chicago. Really well use of the city itself. Yeah. Now, with Getaway, yeah, turn your brain off, make sure nobody around you talks, and you will say,
it's dumb.
But it's a good kind of dumb.
Yeah.
I think it's like, it's not hella bad, it's a good kind of dumb. Go check this out.
Yeah, that was, yeah, after the screening, I thought you and the octogenarians were going to throw down.
Seriously.
It was a nasty scene there for me. I was a little worried.
I was not going to throw down on them because really they're not going to be around much longer.
It's dumb.
I know. I'm a bad person. If you talk in my movie, you're an even worse person. All right. Also opening in theaters today, and I watched this morning, and I, going back to earlier what I said about the critics' condition, I was a little tired. And so we have a film called The Grandmaster, and it is apparently, it's a biofilm that's half historical biopic and half martial arts film.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be about the gentleman who goes by Ip Man, who later in his life would train Bruce Lee. Now, this is also a film. It has the Martin Scorsese and Samuel L. Jackson Presents. I don't think they put down any money. I think they just kind of gave their own.
I think they got paid a little bit of money to use their names.
Okay, they probably got paid a little bit, but they basically saying this movie is A-OK.
Yeah.
And so it's basically two films in one. It is the first half of it. By the way, don't expect a Bruce Lee biopic. Don't expect Dragon. Don't expect and I think martial art fans who just like nonstop fighting are really going to be bummed out by this. But it's and I'm going to butcher. I my apologies to the Chinese community. But it's directed by Kar-Wai Wong, who is, of course, one of the known art house directors in the world. He's directed Chungking Express, In the Mood for Love, 2046. He did My Blueberry Nights with Jude Law and Nora Jones. And it stars Tony Leung, who we know from Red Cliff, Hero. He's also one of Carr's regular actors. He was in Infernal Affairs and Lust Caution. And Zia Zhang, who we know from Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and Memoirs of a Geisha and Rush Hour 2, House of Flying Daggers. And I haven't seen it. There is a Chinese remake of Dangerous Liaisons.
Hmm.
So, but however, I want to see the Ken Watanabe remake of Unforgiven first. Really excited about that. But the first half of the film talks about the differences between martial art instructors in the northern part of China and the southern part of China, which I knew nothing about. So that was kind of interesting. It was almost a kind of a Last Emperor feel. There is some fight stuff. And then the second half of the film is in Hong Kong. He's in exile because the Japanese invade China. And Ip Man moves to Hong Kong and starts developing. And at that time, of course, martial arts were only done for the rich. You did not teach just any common folk, which was something Bruce Lee later carried on when he started doing classes in San Francisco in the 50s and 60s. So if you like, and there's a lot of rain and a lot of snow happening, a lot of slow motion fight scenes, which are fine, but I think I would have liked a little more. I would have liked even a little more variety of speed, like in Getaway, when it comes to the action scenes.
Now, as far as I'm concerned, martial arts movies, whether they're just about action or they're also drama, you know, fall into one of two categories, which is this is more or less grounded in reality and the laws of physics and gravity and things that an actual person could actually do. Or it's just a bunch of screwy BS where basically people are magic and they can fly and do, you know. I mean, like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, great movie, serious movie, but definitely in that Magic Man,
but
you know.
But I mean, I think a serious, mature look at Magic Man stuff.
Yes.
Okay.
But point is, I mean, so whenever you have those sorts of things, if it's not couched in a certain amount of like fantasy and distance from the audience, I always get turned off because it's just like, okay, I know this isn't real. I know no one can actually do this. But we're going to pretend that someone could actually do this. And
I'm going to say it's the former on this one.
Yeah.
I think it's more of that. Yeah, there's not as much wire work. There's a little bit of wire work, unless Z can still do flips like that. And if she does, I'm really impressed.
Yeah.
But no, I think it's more rooted in reality, more rooted in history. So, and one of the things that kind of I need to watch it again, I think. But the second half of the film, I'm listening to the music and I'm listening to the score, and I forgot to write down who did the score, but I start to hear segments, especially the violin scene, violin use from Ennio Morricone's score to Once Upon a Time in America, which is, and by the way, opium plays a part in the last half of the picture. Well, actually the last 20 minutes, but there is, and of course, Once Upon a Time in America, it's all basically a Robert De Niro's opium laced dream, but it does have that kind of almost hazy dreamlike feel to it once the 50s start popping in the Hong Kong sequences. So it just made me giggle. I don't think anybody else all nine other people in the theater knew it was Ennio Morricone. I did. I wish Brian G. Hartz was here because he would back me up on this. but no, it's good. It's not great, but don't go in expecting, you know, a Jackie Chan film or a Bruce Lee, the early years. So I don't have a reaction to that. So we're just going to move on. Because you're listening to Film Sociology. I'm Matthew Sosi, hanging out with Chris Lloyd of the Film Yap. This happens a lot when it's just you and me. We don't need a break. We got 22 minutes left. Let's just keep going, as Thelma said to Louise. So we're going straight to DVD and Blu-ray. I'm not even going to do the Blu-ray test because I'm working the board and I don't know really where it is. But interesting titles this week. Some good, some not so good, and I remember your reactions at one particular screening that we attended, and it's now out on DVD. The big title this week is Baz Luhrmann's The Great Gatsby. Talk about something that is not perfect. Talk about something that's painfully flawed.
I don't know if I could say painfully. I would definitely say flawed. Of course, when you're talking with Luhrmann, flawed is just, you know, brilliant, energetic, and flawed. You can pretty much say about any of his movies, and it's just a question of what the ratio of those things are going to be.
That's a good way of putting it.
I mean, is it going to be Moulin Rouge or is it going to be Australia?
Right.
And for me, the good far outweighed the bad in this one, just because if you've seen previous cinematic adaptations of
Redford,
particularly the 1974 version with Mia Farrow and Robert Redford, I mean, they're just passionless. They're just dead. They're dead things.
Didn't you say that was an art direction in search of a film?
Yeah, that's what I said about the 74 film. It's an art direction. It's a production design in search of a film.
Okay, that's right. That's right.
Because, I mean, it's a beautiful film. Wonderful buildings and costumes and cars and, you know, everything about it. The scenery, just beautiful. And DOA. I mean, the people are
not
just,
Edmund O'Brien.
The people are like mannequins. You know, they just have no passion. And whatever you want to say about this movie, which it does have its flaws, for the first time, I really connected to the character of Jay Gatsby. He really seemed like a person instead of, you know, a writer's ideal of something. It seemed like this was an actual interaction of three or four really vibrant people, flesh and blood folks, as opposed to a condemnation of an age, which is what Fitzgerald's book was really was about. People forget it came out in 1925 in the middle of the Roaring Twenties, and it was basically him saying, hey, everything we're doing sucks.
Only better written.
Only better written than
right.
that.
And yeah, this one, and I know Baz Luhrmann, people either really like his style of filmmaking and people either or really hate it. I don't mind it as much. I understand certain aspects as, to, like I said, there's some of it I think the stuff I liked did outweigh some of the flaws. But I, of course, talk about the flaws because I'm not human. I'm a film critic. But it's interesting that one of the executive producers on this film is Jay-Z. And it shows.
Yeah.
They
blinged it up.
They do bling it up. They do treat these parties like it is a house party going. It's a mansion party, not a blues house party. But it almost felt like at times if, you know, Bravo should have a series on Jay Gatsby, you know, the real millionaires of Long Island.
Yeah. That's the thing I've often wondered about. When I read the book in high school and now.
Did you imagine all that bling ring?
Well, I mean, you look at this party. I mean, they are so over the top that, you know, putting it in today's dollars, I have no idea about back then, but in today's dollars, this would be like a $150,000 party. And he's doing this every night. And I don't know how much stuff you're selling in drugstores, you know, illicit booty, but it's not right. Paying for a $150,000 night party every night.
And by the way, if we get the Super Bowl again, don't do this. So there is that frantic energy. there is, you know, I think DiCaprio is a good choice as Gatsby. Carrie Mulligan, and Isla Fisher are the ladies. No disrespect to Karen Black, who's now departed, and Mia Farrell. I think they're far better than that. Joel Edgerton, I really like.
Yeah, he was good.
And
Tobey Maguire, he's probably a little too old for that role, but I thought he really nailed it. You know, in the previous version, the Sam Waterston. I mean, he's just a totally passive observer, which, I mean, is the role of the character in the book to be the eyes you see it through. But Tobey Maguire's character really had, I thought, some presence here that I didn't see before. One thing, you know, they did change things around more from the book than, you know, including adding a framing device in a sanitarium.
I did not like that at all because
I was kind of iffy about it. I can see why they did it. I don't think it really worked, but I could see why they did it.
I know, but the way it was presented, and his doctor is, oh gosh, Richard Thompson.
Yes,
classic Australian, that guy. But the way it looks, yeah, because Tom is basically in a sanitarium, and it feels like the doctor just tells him to, you know, put out your emotions on paper. And the way it's framed, it looks like he banged out The Great Gatsby overnight.
Yeah, I mean, basically,
I got a problem with that.
They basically end up making the Nick Carraway figure essentially being the stand-in for Fitzgerald himself, my only issue is, you know, if they were going to fiddle around with the book, I wish they would have fiddled with it more, done some things, chopped some things here and there. The one thing is I've always said about the movie versions is whatever her role in the book is, the Nick's girlfriend, whose name I'm not remembering, the golfer.
Right.
In the movie, she's just a completely unnecessary character. I'm waiting for someone to make a movie where they realize, hey, we can just cut her out.
Right. And I think the other issue that I have with the film, and it's the story itself, is we have another, and there's been a number of these this year between Bling Ring and Spring Breakers and a couple, but basically pretty rich people who can't find love.
Yeah.
Aww. You know, and of course he builds something that's bigger than Xanadu from Citizen Kane across the pond to be basically stalking this woman. Yes, I'm the one who says Romeo is stalking Juliet with the balcony scene. It's a little creepy stalk. If I did that, if I built a house across from Michelle Pfeiffer's house, I would be deemed psychotic. But because it's Fitzgerald, it's poetic.
It's real estate stalking.
Sure it is. And don't forget, restraining order means they're thinking of you. Okay, so yeah, no more pretty people, vapid pretty people who have problems.
Speaking of vapid pretty people, Pain and Gain.
You saw my notes. Yes, this was a film, believe it or not, a $25 million film directed by Michael Bay. Again,
comedy with no robots. No, I don't think much CGI.
You could talk to those roided up guys.
Other than that toe, not a lot of special effects.
Not a lot of special effects, and it's based on a true story because every other film is inspired by a true story of some muscle bound lunkheads in the 80s Miami. Mark Wahlberg, Anthony Mackie, and Dwayne Johnson, who's very funny in this.
Yes, Dwayne Johnson, I've said for years, has a wonderful sense of comic timing. He's shown it in a bunch of movies. What was the sequel?
Be Cool.
Be Cool, which is not a very good movie, but he's great in that.
Yeah, he's really good. But anyway, so these three guys decide to pull off a kidnapping heist on Rich D-Bag, played by Tony Shalhoub. And, of course, things don't go as planned. Ed Harris shows up a little bit, and I remember we talked about, I liked it more than you did. I was with the film longer. The first hour or so, it captures this kind of 80s, muscled up, coked up, roided, frantic energy of trying to be the best that you can be and being a winner. And, you know, the music from the Karate Kid training music is playing. And then, of course, you know, it's a heist of a person, so that's not going to go well. We've seen that before. But the problem is they have to do one more job in order to pay off their habits.
Yeah.
And I immediately grew tired of it quickly.
Yeah.
And of course, it slugged on for another 30 minutes or so.
Yeah, I never really got too much into this movie at all. It seemed like a neat idea that they never – I guess my main thing was I thought they should have been making more fun of this subculture.
Absolutely.
Of this whole bodybuilding, which to me is one of the funniest undertakings of mankind ever.
Pumping iron.
These guys who turn themselves into a caricature of the male body, and they actually think they look good and that everyone wants to look at them. And they don't realize that this is such a tiny, tiny subset. You know, it's a creepy little subculture that, you know, they think is really cool, and they don't realize that everyone else is just like, that's kind of nasty.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, and that's, you know, the look of the male body changes in the movies with time. And so, as you say, in that time, it was Stallone, Schwarzenegger was big. Now they've gone a little smaller, but now it's Hugh Jackman and Wolverine, this vascularity thing. Mm-hmm. It's like they want to see all the veins popping.
And they kind of do. And I remember the muscle magazines in the 70s. Those are other ones. Every vein looked like Lewis Black's forehead. You think it was just going to, a blood vessel was going to pop.
You know,
open.
And it's like those things always go together. It's like, you know, like they always wear shirts that are way too small for them. And it's just like.
And well, speedos that are way too small for them.
Is it just that clothing is not available in your size now? Or is that, you know, you started wearing those clothes before you got big, and just, you know, now they're not big anymore.
Look at me.
You know, and there's always over tanning. You know, they always look like, you know, it's like the white guys look like they've just been, you know, burnt to like a, you know, a dense orange.
Or Mike Ditka.
Yeah. And you know, and this whole, you know, the veins popping. You know, basically what they're trying to do, and I hope this isn't inappropriate for satellite radio.
If you have to question it, it probably is. That's me saying this.
They're trying to turn their bodies so that they look like an engorged penis.
Thank you. Okay. That's not bad, actually. You can say that on public radio.
Yes.
Just not very often. So yeah, Pain and Gain. It was tiring. It was tiring. Actually, wait a
minute. It's dumb. It was not engorged.
Yeah. Did you see The Reluctant Fundamentalist?
Did not. Okay.
Got it in the mail. Just didn't have time to see it.
Well, it's out on. And then I want to talk about a film that is out on DVD and Blu-ray. Didn't get enough press, and I'm hopefully going to have one of the actors.
I think I know which one you're talking about.
On the show, hopefully in the next week or so. He has not talked to me. We've talked about going on the show, coming on the show sometime. But it is the farm drama At Any Price, which stars Dennis Quaid, Zac Efron, Heather Graham, and local Indianapolis – well, actually, he's outside of Indy. But Indiana singer, songwriter, and actor Tim Grimm, who we'll hopefully have on the show. But I remember seeing this, and our colleague Ed Johnsonat was also there. We had talked about this film for quite a bit while after the movie. The only thing I knew at the time was it was the Dennis Quaid farm movie, for lack of a better thing. Quaid is a second-generation farmer, third-generation farmer, and he's got two boys he's ready to pass the land on to, and one of them is Zac Efron, and Zac doesn't want anything to do with the farm. He just wants to race cars and raise hell and not do anything. And as I heard this, I went, huh, that's kind of a Heartland Film Festival plot line, a Truly Moving Pictures thing. Oh, this film is so not that.
No.
You learn quickly, if not the swearing and the sex scenes. But it's not, and this is, of course, not a dig on Truly Moving Pictures.
Because they do adult material. It's just,
grown-up material. But it goes down a much darker path than I had anticipated. In fact, the last third of the film, I even started saying Shakespeare in the Corn.
Wow.
As a compliment, like Shakespeare in the Fields. If you remember the book and the film A Thousand Acres, which was kind of a farm version of King Lear, choices are made that just go down deeper and deeper and deeper when it comes to Efron's character and Dennis Quaid's character. And I was really impressed that they kept going down this dark path, and I don't think I'm giving away too much, but they stick with the storyline of a Shakespearean tragedy. And what I mean is they don't wimp out the last 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And I was kind of impressed with that.
Well, see, I was interested to see this when they screened it, and I couldn't go to the screening. It came and went so fast from a theater. I mean, just blink of an eye.
Yeah, that was kind of a bummer. Tim Grimm has a couple fun stories about when they screened it in Columbus, Indiana. I'll save that for him. But I think Ed compared it to one of the character-driven films of the 70s where nobody in the film is likable. But you're still engaged watching it.
Yeah.
So I was really impressed with this. And so kudos for these guys to make a dark farm drama. So hopefully we'll have Tim on a little bit later on a show.
You're talking about talking. He and you, right?
Yes, he and
I. Talking about talking.
Talking about talk. Did I say that?
No, I'm saying that.
Okay.
It's dumb.
There you go. Some old titles on DVD and Blu-ray, and then we'll get to Dead People We Like. Criterion has put out the original 1942 version to Be or Not to Be with Jack Benny.
Wow.
So they do comedies, which is nice to know. I'm sure, yes, our Bob Bloom, our colleague up in Lafayette, he's very excited. He's brought this up. 1982's Cue the Winged Serpent. And also The Idolmaker. Do you remember that? Ray Sharkey. I think Peter Gallagher and his eyebrows are on it. Olive Films put out the 1950 James Cagney drama Kiss Tomorrow Goodbye. And what's funny is it's in big letters, James Cagney, but also at the bottom in big letters, directed by Gordon Douglas. Gordon Douglas was kind of a journeyman director. I mean, he directed, I think, a couple of the Rat Pack films, some Burt Reynolds films. I think he did Slaughter with Jim Brown, but just kind of a studio guy. So the fact that he got huge font size on the DVD cover, Blu-ray cover, good for him. Also on Olive Films, which is an interesting label that they put out these kind of lesser-known older titles, like the 1941 Cary Grant film Penny Serenade and the 1952 film Flat Top with Sterling Hayden.
Wow,
these are titles for your blog.
I did Flat Top on Reeling Backward just a couple 3 months ago.
Did you?
I did indeed.
And what is what's Reeling Back this week?
I don't remember. Well,
you did Funny Girl, I think.
Yeah, it was Funny Girl. It was Funny Girl, or is that the one coming out? Yeah, it was Funny Girl. I apologize because you and I.
You write them so far in advance.
I'm working like 2 months ahead, so like you know the one like you know I just saw Magic 1978
Ooh.
Film with Anthony Hopkins. So, but it'll show up in you know November. So
that's all right. Well, we'll get to Dead People We Like. Because we don't have time for dead people we don't like. And this was, the last couple of weeks were particularly busy, but want to raise a glass and tip and a salute to actress Julie Harris, who was 87 years old. Now, probably best known as a stage actress.
Yeah, she was one of these people who really, and people don't realize television. Go look at her television credits.
It's impressive.
She did a lot of television, and she just moved pretty seamlessly from film to stage to television, and I think I know she won nominations.
Well, actually,
for
10 Tony nominations, 5 wins,
which tied for all-time best with someone else.
Yes, but her first film, she got a Best Supporting Actress nomination for
Member of the Wedding.
Yep.
And
then her follow-up film.
Can't remember.
East of Eden.
That was right.
Yeah, not bad.
I would love to make a list. I bet you somewhere somebody has a list on the web of somebody, you know, actors or actresses who earn an Oscar nomination in their very first film role.
Timothy Hutton. An Oscar? You mean an actual win?
No, a nomination.
Oh, nomination.
Just a nomination.
Oh, that's we'll have to work on that. That's a homework project. John Cazale?
Yeah.
Of course, yeah, John Cazale, he wasn't a nomination. Every film he was in got a Best Picture nomination.
Yeah.
That's right. So,
probably Quavenzhe Wallace from last year.
Yes, true.
Unless she was in another movie when she was 2.
I don't know. So, anyway, she follows up, The Member of the Wedding with East of Eden, of course, with the Mighty Three with James Dean. I Am a Camera. And then, a lot of stuff. There was TV movies of A Doll's House and Johnny Belinda. Requiem for a Heavyweight, which I would like to watch again with Anthony Quinn.
Great movie.
The original and really good, The Haunting. She played Ophelia opposite Richard Burton as Hamlet. Going through Reflections in a Golden Eye, a bat spit crazy psychological drama directed by John Huston with Marlon Brando, Elizabeth Taylor, Julie Harris, Brian Keith, and a naked Robert Forrester. You're welcome. The Split, which I've actually reviewed here into the archives. It was a crime drama with Jim Brown and Gene Hackman in the late 60s. The People Next Door. Of course, there was a TV version of The Virginian. A lot of folks in, I guess, our age would know her. She was on Falcon Crest for many, many years. Let's go on through The Hiding Place. Voyage of the Damned from 1976. This is from 1979. I have this on VHS. I want this on DVD because it is so damn bad. But the film version of The Bell Jar, the Sylvia Plath novel with, I think it was Marion Keller, who is best known as the lady from The Other Side of the Mountain.
Mm.
Not a good representation of Miss Plath. Bronte. And the Gin Game, I know, I think they made, they didn't make a film of that, but I know that's a great two-person play that she did with Charles Durning. Gorillas in the Mist, House Sitter, The Dark Half. That was part of the weird Timothy Hutton doing thrillers phase along with The Temp. Carried Away, Bad Manners, and The Way Back Home, among others. So, wow. Julia, yeah, fine
Very
actress.
Busy lady.
Very busy lady. Speaking of directors, you know, kind of journeyman directors, Ted Post died at the age of 95. And the first thing that comes, because he also did a lot of TV in the 50s and 60s, Wagon Train and Gunsmoke. But the very first thing I noticed him as a director, he directed Magnum Force, the second Dirty Harry film. And but I know before that, he did the sequel to Planet of the Apes. Was it Beneath the Planet of the Apes, I believe it was called?
It was off to the side of the Planet of the Apes.
Yes, very funny. Beneath the Planet of the Apes. Again, just a working guy. Peyton, he did Hang 'Em High, which was Clint Eastwood's first American Western. Magnum Force, we talked about The Baby, The Herod Experiment. Good Guys Wear Black. Yes, he directed Chuck Norris. And before, the same year, he directed Burt Lancaster in Go Tell the Spartans and Night Kill. So just, again, a working guy. Also, he also directed Michael Dudikoff in The Human Shield.
Wow.
That was near the end of his career. Stephanie McMillan, who was a set director, art director, who won an Oscar in 1996 for her work in The English Patient.
Wow.
But she also did all of the Potter films.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive.
That's some pretty dense work there.
Yeah. Other noted films that she worked on, Chocolat, Notting Hill, The Bad Avengers, Fierce Creatures, In Love and War, Mary Riley, Shadowlands, The Secret Garden, Year of the Comet, Under Suspicions, Fish Called Wanda, and her first two films were Santa Claus the Movie and Give My Regards to Broad Street, that Paul McCartney video from the 80s. And finally, cinematographer Gilbert Taylor, who did a lot of movies in the 40s and 50s. A lot of English films I had not heard of. But once we get into the 1960s, the first thing he was a director of photography for Dr. Strangelove.
Wow.
And in that same year, director of photography for A Hard Day's Night. Ooh. Then he did Ferry Across the Mersey. Because every British band got a movie back then. The Bedford Incident, Cul-de-Sac, Repulsion, Blood Fiend. He did the Roman Polanski version of Macbeth. Frenzy was director of photography on that. And then back-to-back years, he worked on the original The Omen and Star Wars.
Wow.
So that's not a bad career to have.
No, not at all.
So all of those titles, if you're not seeing anything, this weekend, of course, is the last film at the IMA, right?
Yeah, tonight, The Breakfast Club, the last, not the last movie ever, the last movie for their summer movie night season. Unfortunately, if you don't have tickets, I think it's actually been sold out for like a week, because every Generation Xer among us apparently is going.
I'm not.
I'm not either.
I'm sorry, but I think John Hughes is way overrated.
Oh, I think he's way underrated.
Underrated. I'll tell you what got in the way of me of really, even in my teen years, appreciating it. S.E. Hinton.
Yeah.
Because remember in 1982, 1983, you had Tex, and then you had the Francis Coppola S.E. Hinton double feature of The Outsiders and Rumblefish. And I gravitated toward those films a lot more than Chicago suburban teen angst.
I liked him because he showed teens the way they really were, and you know, generally cast actual teens to play them as opposed to 28-year-olds.
You see, I think Coppola does the same thing, but yeah. That's no, and you know, good, not great. And The Breakfast Club, I would love for every clique to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony. They're not.
Yeah.
So what else is going on in the film? Yep. What's coming up?
Well, of course, Elmer Leonard, for those of you know who passed, we actually had an interview with him a couple of years ago.
As did we here on the show.
So a two-parter that's currently up there right now if you haven't already seen it. We just put up a new podcast. So that should be with our Summer Movie Awards for What's Good and What's Bad.
A lot of What's Bad.
I should probably create a new page on the thing for TV stuff now since I'm now on the TV.
You're on the telly.
Yeah, what do you think about that? Is that weird?
No. I did television for a year and a half. They let me on. You're fine.
Yeah, I don't know. It's that sort of thing where you feel like a gorilla who's just wandered into like the cute baby animal room, and there people are like, "Get out!"
Yes, that's what they said about me. So speaking of Elmore Leonard.
Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
We're a real show because Elmore Leonard said so. Thank you. All right, Chris Lloyd, go to the filmyapp.com.
Or you can now go to the Indie Style webpage, and they do have my segment there segmented out so that you can go take a look at that.
So there you go. Fridays at 9, hopefully on earlier.
The deal I've made with my boss at my actual real work and the Indie Style show is I'm going to go on as soon after 9 a.m. as absolutely possible. So if you're watching live, just tune in right around 9, and I should be along shortly. Or check the website, and have it up.
We need you in the kitchen cooking with Andy and Tracy.
That kitchen is amazing.
Isn't it?
I would love to just take that whole kitchen and put it in instead of my actual kitchen.
You shouldn't have said that. All right, until next time, go see a good movie. You deserve it. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. Go Lions next week. Thank God. See ya.